Now, when people talk about today's markets with the meme coins and Bitcoin and all this other silliness, they have no idea how insane the market was in 2000. It was just absolutely staggering. You could buy a, like, stocks would go up 50% in one day on nothing. And then the next day go up another 50%. And the next day another 50%. And people thought they were absolute geniuses, me included. But when you start managing money for other clients, you learn very quickly, you can't own those stocks. You will be out of business in a minute and you'll be sued and you'll never work in the industry again. So it's very eye-opening experience, and I learned a lot. It was very important for me to go through bad markets starting out my career.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? The opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex, adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Barry Schwartz. Barry is the Executive Vice President and Chief Investment Officer of Baskin Wealth Management. He has more than two decades of market experience and regularly shares his insights in the media through both Twitter/X and his own podcast called Long Term Investing. Barry, it's an honor to have you on. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. It's so great to be here, and I hope I can share some of my thoughts about investing, and I'm sure we'll have a great chat.
Sweet. And let's kick things off, I guess, with Baskin itself, and then we'll kind of dive into your personal career. But I guess, can you give an overview of what Baskin Wealth Management is? What's the goal of the firm? And we've had some managers that use a single strategy. It sounds like Baskin uses separately managed accounts. Can you give an explanation on the difference and some of the benefits of that?
Absolutely. The goal of Baskin Wealth Management is to make our clients money. That's the goal of investing other people's money. And my goal is to also come up with great investment ideas because I want to own the exact same investments that my clients have. There's 100% skin in the game. I own every single investment. I'm probably the largest shareholder of any stocks that our clients own. So if they go down, I go down. So the bottom line for Baskin Wealth Management is we manage separately managed accounts for high net worth clients across Canada. Hopeful we'll be able to manage accounts in the United States very shortly. And we treat every client as if we're managing 100% of their investable wealth, even if we aren't. That's the strategy we try to take. So we're not trying to hit a grand slam every time. We're trying to provide a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, cash, whatever asset is appropriate, given the client's risk tolerance. And we also do full wealth planning, financial planning, that kind of stuff. So we like to have close relationships with our clients, get to know their strategy. We're dealing with, I would call the type of clients we're dealing with are the millionaire next door. Clients that have worked very hard, doctors, lawyers, entrepreneurs, you name them, people that have inherited money, and they're looking to grow their portfolios for their retirements. We don't deal with any family offices or institutional investors. And so our strategy, Ryan, is to own the best businesses wherever we can find them in our equity portfolio. We really prefer owning about 30 different equities and then sprinkling on fixed income where appropriate according to the client's investment policy statement.
All right. And we'll get into some of those companies specifically later on in the discussion. But as for your own career, you've now been at Baskin, I believe, for right around 25 years. I guess, what skills did you come into the company with? I know this is going back a couple of years now. What skills did you come into the company with, and what would you say you best developed over your time there?
Yep, this will be my 25th year at Baskin, and I can't forget the year because it's the same year I got married, so it coincides with my anniversary. So hopefully I'll stay married as long as I stay at Baskin Wealth Management, one and the same. I got lucky, Ryan. I started working at Baskin right out of graduating an MBA at Schulich School of Business in Toronto, saw a job posting. This is what I wanted to do after doing my MBA. I really wanted to work in wealth management. I wanted to help research stocks, investments. I landed a job with David Baskin 25 years ago as a research analyst, really jack of all trades, doing a lot of different things in our business. We were, at that point in time, Baskin Wealth Management was managing about $25 million for 20 families. We've now grown to about 2.7 billion Canadian for maybe 1,500 families, so a significant growth. But we're still doing the same things we were doing 25 years ago. Getting to know our clients, making sure the relationship fits, making sure we articulate our investment strategy, being patient with our investments, really just being a good friend to our clients as well, helping them out with any service we can. And that's what we think makes a successful wealth management firm. I know that the retail investors, those managing their own portfolios, would love to, you know, have amazing returns all the time and pick the best stocks. But it's to us, it's more important about what you don't own and what you avoid than and to stay in business for over 25 years is very important to us. And so we have to make sure we treat our clients' portfolios with the highest fiduciary responsibilities. And sometimes that there, you know, you don't always get the 100% best returns. But what you do get is peace of mind and growth and sustainability, and that's what's very important to us.
From an investment analysis perspective, what would you say, I guess, have you changed at all over 25 years? Is there any lessons that have kind of stuck with you that you've learned over your time?
For sure. I think like any investor, when they're starting out, they really like to be more of a value-oriented investor. It's what we learn in business school. It's what we learn when we start reading Benjamin Graham and we start learning about value stocks, dividend payers. Those are the types of investments that I think most investors graduate to. Keep in mind, 25 years ago, there weren't the type of quality stocks there are today. There was no such thing as an Apple the way it is now, or a Google or a Microsoft or a Visa. These didn't exist. You know, the largest companies when I started out were oil and gas companies, Ford, General Motors, IBM. You know, those are the types of businesses. Then this dot-com thing started to take off, and it really threw a lot of older fund managers and investors for a loop, because no one could rationalize why these companies were going straight up, yet they had no profits, no earnings, just baloney metrics. And of course, it turned out 99% of them were BS. So that was an interesting time for me to start at an investing shop, although I worked for a few years at a fund management company prior to Baskin, just experiencing the absolute craziness. Now, when people talk about today's markets with the meme coins and Bitcoin and all this other silliness, they have no idea how insane the market was in 2000. It was just absolutely staggering. You could buy stocks would go up 50% in one day on nothing. And then the next day, go up another 50%. And the next day, another 50%. And people thought they were absolute geniuses, me included. But when you start managing money for other clients, you learn very quickly, you can't own those stocks. You can't, you will be out of business in a minute and you'll be sued. And you'll never work in the industry again. So it's very eye-opening experience. And I learned a lot. It was very important for me to go through bad markets starting out my career.
Okay, let's dig in a bit to Baskin's process. So I guess take me through the life cycle from new idea comes across your desk, or someone on the team gets a new idea, to actual portfolio addition. What is that research process?
Well, we have
like
a very concentrated research team. It's really just me and Ernest Wong, our head of research, who are generating ideas and following the companies in our portfolio. No question, at our company, every portfolio manager is involved in knowledge about the companies we own, and certainly can provide assistance on research and investment ideas. But we think it's best that we don't have a team of 10 or 15 analysts coming up with ideas, because the investable universe of the types of companies we want to own, it's very small, no more than 100 companies, especially because we avoid owning companies outside North America pretty much. We may look at Europe, but we're really much concentrated on North America. So we're investors. We like to hold companies for a long period of time. So to me, when Ernest presents an idea or anybody else presents an idea, I immediately think to myself, is this a Baskin company? And what do I mean by a Baskin company? Is it a company where at least we have some ability to predict revenues and earnings into the future? Is it something where a generalist can understand without having a PhD in some kind of specialized field? Is it a business where we think the management can reinvest the cash flows at high rates of return? Is it a business where the management has specific skills to run businesses and have the track record to create value? Is it a business where the management has significant skin in the game, or at least a owner-operated mindset? Is it a business where we're not overpaying for future growth? So those are the types of things on our checklist. I mean, we don't have a formal checklist, but these are the things that we think about very carefully because we want to buy a company and let it grow. We always say here, if we buy a business and we own a business where the fundamentals are improving year over year and not a lot has changed to the thesis, we're going to stick with it. And our process is to buy companies where we hope we can double our results over 5 years. We're looking for a double over 5 years. So to achieve that, we have to own companies that have the ability to grow earnings per share or free cash flow per share by 12 to 15% a year. No, it's not always possible, but those are the things we look for. And Ryan, if you get a few of those right, it makes all the difference because you're going to find a company that will compound very, very quickly and start being a real big, a huge opportunity in the portfolio. Makes all your other mistakes go away.
Yeah, and we'll talk about, I guess, a couple of those mm-hmm. winners here in a sec. Between you and Ernest, is there any sort of, I guess, formal pitch for a new idea to one another? What does that process look like?
Ernest and I talk on Teams probably every single day of the week at all hours. To be successful in investing, I think you have to have the passion for this. You have to be some kind of a crazy person like we are who thinks about stocks and this is their number one hobby and passion. I like golf. I'm not good at it. I play pickleball. I'm not good at it. But those are not passions for me. You can say the same thing for Ernest. He loves backgammon. He likes video games. He probably now with young kids, he's spending a lot of time there, but it's investing. We both read books about investing. We read blogs about investing. We send each other little clips from Twitter. Did you read that? Did you see this? This is what we do all day long. So he and I would be doing these things even if we weren't paid for it, if we were doing something else. So I'm not sure that answered your question, but that's how we think about investing. And so if we're thinking about investing pretty much while we're sleeping, while we're dreaming, hopefully we've got a leg up on other investors.
Would you say you spend more time researching your existing holdings, or I guess maintenance type research, or new ideas?
Maintenance is the most important, right? Because we're not looking to get rid of names in our portfolio. We're looking to love our companies even more. We're looking to start a relationship with them and can continue to fall in love with them every single day. The way we think about our companies is we want to own 30 of the best businesses wherever we can find them, where we think we understand the rule of law, the accounting, we're comfortable with the geography of where their businesses are located. And once we found them, we're not looking for a reason to sell them. We're looking for a reason to buy more of them. That's really our process. The challenging thing about having a separately managed account for clients is, you're buying more of your existing names all the time. It's just the way it is. A client comes in, they don't get a portion of the fund. They get 30 stocks, individual holdings. We like separately managed accounts because each client, they get to see what they own. There's full transparency. They know they can log into their custodian, their broker every day and see what they own. They can see the good, the bad, and the ugly. Of course, they only beat us up on the ugly. They own the stocks. They get pride of ownership. If someone fires us, if someone leaves us, they don't walk away with cash. They walk away with their securities if they want them. And I want that for our clients. That should be the way our world works. Of course, it would be more sticky if we had our clients in funds, and we do offer a couple funds for our clients for small relationships. And maybe one day we'll add more of that in the future. But so once you're doing separately managed accounts, you're really have to be a long-term owner. Because especially with capital gains involved, we've owned some companies, Ryan, Brookfield for 20 plus years, National Bank for 20 years, Google, Apple, Microsoft, we own those for 10 plus years. You know, the Waste Connections I've owned in its previous form for since 2003, I think. You know, these are stocks in our portfolio that have gone up, some have gone up 2, 3, 5, 10, 15, 20 multiples, right? So clients' capital gains are very, very important, top of mind for us on an individual basis.
Well, looking at your portfolio list and a couple of the companies you just named, it seems Baskin puts a super heavy emphasis on quality. And you alluded to some of these earlier, but what are some of the specific qualities you're looking for in a potential investment?
Sure. So the reason why we've settled on owning quality is if you're going to be a long-term investor, you can't do a lot of trading, right? And it doesn't fit with our type of, I'm not saying you can do however you invest however you want, but for our temperament, for our comfort level, we don't want to be traders. And so if you're going to own companies, own them, you have to own companies that have quality characteristics for the long term. Where you get, and if you get hurt on quality companies, you're probably just going to get hurt on multiple compression. Whereas if you own lousy companies, you can get hurt in so many different ways. So I'll take my chances with multiple compression and pivot more towards growth. So that's the type of business that appeals to us. I forgot the first part of your question.
No, just the characteristics you look for in those great businesses.
Well, I think I covered them earlier, right? We're looking for businesses that have the ability to reinvest cash flows at high rates of return. That's what compounding is all about. I want to partner with psychopaths that are running companies. I call these people psychopaths because they're billionaires. They're worth hundreds of millions of dollars, yet they come to work every day trying to make more money for you as a shareholder and for themselves. You know, many people will say, you know, if I hit my retirement number, I'm out. I hate working. These people love working. I want to partner with managers, owner operators that love going to work. They do it for the love of the game. Mark Zuckerberg, what is this guy? He doesn't need to work anymore. He can do whatever he wants. He can go, wakeboarding and surfing for the rest of his life. He doesn't need any of this money or the stress or the heartache or the pain and punishment. But they do it. And so these are the types of people we need to partner with. There's not many of these people. So once we find one of those guys or women who runs those businesses, we want to stick with it. So the quality characteristic for us is really twofold. It's the ability to reinvest these free cash flows at high rates of return and the management quality, the ability of the management that who has the history to reinvest and knows what to do when things aren't working out. And once you find out that winning combination, you hold on. Not every business that we own, Ryan, is like a great business model. The greatest business models in the world are Visa, MasterCard, Microsoft, FICO, Moody's, S&P Global, you know, Constellation Software. These are like companies that require no capital expenditure. Well, Microsoft now, but in the past, required really no capital expenditures to grow their cash flows, right? But not all, but they didn't always have great reinvestment opportunities for their free cash flows, right? Moody's or S&P Global is arguably maybe not reinvesting their cash flows the best. Or FICO now, it doesn't know what to do with its cash flow, so it's buying back its stock at 60 or 70 times earnings. Is that the best use of its cash flow? I don't know. But so you want to own those type of businesses, and you also want to own companies where they know how to reinvest cash flows, but the business model may not be as good. You know, examples of that are like a Couche-Tard in Canada or TFI International. No one's going to say owning a convenience store is a good business. It's a tough, terrible, competitive business, CapEx heavy, or owning a trucking business. But in those businesses, you can own outliers where they know how to create value by reinvesting cash flows at high rates of return and keeping costs under control. And so we're also attracted to those type of businesses as well. And that's, it all comes back, Ryan, to management, skin in the game, those psychopaths who love to work, those guys that have figured it out, you know, the and the business and those businesses endure. The TransDigm, Nick Howley's no longer running TransDigm, but he's still around. I think he's worth $1 billion. He's still chairman, right? He's not. He's done. He's got a beautiful beach house and doing whatever he wants to do. But he's very invested. Bezos, he has this, even though he's on his yacht living life, living La Vida Loca, he's still worth a few $100 billion and sold all his Amazon. So if the poop hits the fan, he would come back.
Yeah, it's psychopath as a term of endearment, it sounds like.
Oh, yes.
Hey, listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs the show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview. So it sounds like a lot of the companies that you own today, you've had for quite a while in the portfolio. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. It sounds also like Baskin is pretty reluctant to sell for the most part. What would cause a sale decision?
Yeah. Well, I think most of my sale decisions have been bad. So it's just from experience. And why do I say that? Because I think for the most part, we just owned good companies that were compounding and sold them because there was a temporary worry. So I've made so many dumb sale decisions that I really want to be careful. So if I made a bad sale decision, if I made a good sale decision, it's probably because I bought a bad company. Because we're not traders, right? We own Netflix, right? So Netflix, we started buying when it was $375 during the pandemic. If I was smart, I would have sold it at $700, and I didn't. And it ran to $180, and then it back up to $1,000. And if I was smart, maybe I sell it today, but I want a long-term owner. So the sale decision for us is threefold, to be more specific in answering your question. Number one, we'll sell a company if we found a better investment idea, right? We're always comparing new ideas to what we have. Is it better than what I currently have? Or should I just buy more shares of Meta or Constellation Software? Number two, we'll sell if it's clear that our assessment of the long-term viability of the company wasn't as good as our original thesis. We'll sell if, management does. I mean, and this is really goes back into the second reason. If management does something that changes the fundamentals of the business, disruption, or maybe the senior people step down and we're not comfortable with the new management running. And that's really it. You notice that I said I don't sell because the stock price goes down. Yeah, right? That doesn't bother me. Or I don't sell because I'm worried about Donald Trump putting on tariffs or some kind of event that I can't control about anyways. Those are not reasons for us to sell as long-term owners. We're hopeful that we own good enough business that they will stand the test of time. We own 30. I'm hopeful that most, if not all, will do very, very well. You said we tend to hold long. And here's the proof. Out of the top 25 companies in our portfolio right now, the top 25 holdings, 19 of them are multi-baggers. You don't get multi-baggers from companies, or at least I can't, for holding them for 1 month or 1 year, right? You get them from holding them a long period of time. So 19 out of the top 25 names are multi-baggers. So that means they've gone up more than one time. They've two times, three times. And the remaining six are newer positions, and hopefully those will work out.
A lot of the business models you named there are very different. You've got big tech software, you've got logistics, I think with TFI International, you've got convenience stores. So it sounds like the type of company that Baskin is willing to buy is pretty flexible. Do you have any hard rules in your investment process?
Yes, we do. So our founder, David Baskin, set up the business to say, we're never going to buy companies that are in tobacco. We're never going to buy companies that make weapons, so like guns or missiles or those kind of things. And we're never going to buy companies that operate on online gambling. Those are those three areas that he would never want his name associated with. And we're going to stick with those three areas. Where we're not comfortable, Ryan, is really more about business models. We have very limited allocation to commodities, cyclicals, capital expenditure, regulated companies focus more on dividends, high leverage businesses that are dividend payers. Those kind of names we tend, for the most part, to avoid. We don't have a hard and fast rule, but I'm no PhD in chemistry. I don't think I can add any value researching biotechnology stocks, those kind of science names. I don't feel like we're qualified here to purchase. And so for the most part, we're then kind of parceled into industrials, financial services, technology, data, information tech. But we own a couple oil stocks, and we own them because, not because we have a view on where oil is going to go or natural gas is going to go, but because these are run by those psychopaths, Murray Edwards at CNQ and Mike Rose at Tourmaline Oil, two Canadian, terrific, well-run, amazing Canadian oil and gas plays. And they're proof. These guys know how to create value. Canadian Natural Resources, since its inception, has done as well as Microsoft. Two complete different business models, but both have achieved it in different ways. And one by being a great capital allocator, one being one of the best businesses in the world.
All right, let's shift gears a bit and talk about some of those individual positions, and I guess maybe some of the broader themes in the Baskin portfolio. So earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that the largest companies in the world today are a little different than the largest companies in the world 20 years ago. What makes them different? Because I've seen those charts where it's like the top 10 largest companies in the US or in North America, and they tend to turn over after a couple of decades. What do you think makes it different this time?
It's the software, the platform growth, the cloud computing, the ability to sell your products and services globally without major capital expenditures. The internet really changed things, right? So the Magnificent Seven and Broadcom and those are really technology businesses, right? And they didn't exist in the same form or fashion they do today, 20, 25 years ago, because of the proliferation of the internet helped these businesses grow. And so we made a decision to own a lot of these platform businesses that are ubiquitous, and people love the products and services in every single country that they're in. And if they're not allowed in those countries, you see that they have copycats in the countries that they're not allowed into, right? It's fascinating. So those are the best business models. Arguably, they may not be as good business models today, given that they now need to spend enormous amounts of money for the next leg of growth, which is the AI data centers and AI expansion. But we'll see if those turn out to be great uses of capital. I'm hopeful that it will be. And certainly these companies are not stupid. But, those are the types of businesses that are the largest in our portfolios. The two largest holdings in our portfolio are Apple and Constellation Software. Although Ryan, as a separately managed account manager, largest positions at Baskin are not as relevant because each client has their own portfolio and different weightings. What's important to us is really the 30, not just what is the largest and what is the smallest, because we're buying all of those 30 today for new clients.
Okay. And with the sort of CapEx boom that we're seeing, it sounds like you're fairly optimistic that it's going to be the right investment. Would you be more concerned if they weren't making the investments, or are you concerned at all with the sheer dollar amount that's being invested?
I just think there's sticker shock on the sheer dollar. And I think a lot of, we'll call it FinTwit, is, making fun of it because, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, and it sounds similar to the spending on the AI boom, the dot-com boom, the fiber optic spend, if you recall, the JDS uniphases and all these companies laying fiber optics. and other booms that turned out to be busts in the past, right? If you look through history, the boom in the launching canals and railroads and you name it, TVs and cars. You know, at one point in time, there was like 50 different car makers in the U.S. And so rightfully so to be skeptical. But something is a lot different this time. My argument is, well, even if the AI boom turns out to be a bust, you're not paying a stupid multiple for Amazon or Google or Meta right today. And even if they throw that $60 or $70 or $100 billion out the window, their core businesses are still so good and generating and printing so much cash that they'll be fine. And we have no idea, of course, what other areas they're investing in terms of their research and development. But I'll take them at their word. I think that, you know, when they tell us they're capacity constrained, that their customers need it, that they need it for their own infrastructure. You know, Meta is a perfect example. Meta doesn't offer hyperscaling cloud computing for customers. It's all for its own infrastructure. So that $60 to $65 billion is harder to see a tangible return on invested capital because it's going to support its own business growth. So they have to be extremely careful. You know, people were freaking out about Meta throwing money out at the Reality Labs. This is even more so. You know, people now believe that Zuckerberg has the best exposure to AI, and proof is in the evidence of, you know, customers paying more for AI advertising and placements, and those things are working on the Meta platform. So he should be doing it. And in the meantime, it's not like these companies are borrowing money to invest. It's not like they're going to go bankrupt if AI doesn't work. They're using existing free cash flow, and they all have beautiful balance sheets. So I think you have to give them the benefit of the doubt. I think for the most part, you know, we had a little hiccup after the Q4 earnings, but I think for the most part, these companies are still, you know, can't complain. If you've owned Amazon or Google over the last 12 or 18 months, you've done okay.
Yeah, it's been a good ride for those shareholders. Let's talk about another big winner, which is Apple. You mentioned this is one of the largest holdings in throughout the portfolios at Baskin. It seems like Apple is surprisingly a bit of a polarizing stock. You have a lot of people, a lot of, I guess, quote unquote, value investors that they look at the trailing growth and they say, this multiple makes no sense. And then on the flip side, they're returning a ton of cash to shareholders and the stock continues to go up, I guess, over, if we zoom out a few years. What do you think, and I guess on Apple generally, and why do you like it as an investment today?
Sure. So let me give our listeners a little history of Baskin and our relationship with Apple. We started buying the shares for our clients around 2012, 2013. So our cost base is quite low, as you can imagine. And we've held it in clients' accounts since those that have started with us at that time and continue to add it. We've trimmed it a number of times in our portfolio. One of our rules is we try not to let any one stock get more than 10% of a client's separately managed allocation, just a way to protect the client in case of our stupidity or market stupidity or anything that can happen. It turns out that the only stupid people have been us trimming it, but that's besides the point. Why do we like it? So we, you know, obviously to us, the most important thing in the world is the distribution, your relationship with the customer. And Apple has so much goodwill, right? 1.4 billion iPhone users, 2.3 plus billion device users. And once people buy a Mac or an iPhone or they tend to buy more. They buy an iPad, then they buy the AirPods, then they buy the watch, then they pay for other services, then they have to pay more for cloud and storage. So our thesis is pretty simple. They've created 2.3 billion relationships that people love using their products. And as the proliferation of AI and technology improves, Apple won't be the first mover, but it'll be the winner, I think, in every single type of innovation that comes going forward. So they may not be the most innovative company, but they have the most trust by their customers. And so in the future, we think as people start using, you know, glasses, right, or humanoid robots or other types of AI services, the winner is going to be the guy who has the distribution that owns the funnel, and that's Apple. And one of the fantastic things that Apple's doing, we talked about $70, $100 billion of CapEx. Apple's spending nothing on CapEx. They're letting all these guys do it for them. Apple doesn't need to spend any money on CapEx because people are building the infrastructure around Apple to get access to the 2+ billion users of Apple products. So in the future, I can't tell you what products and services they'll be having, but I can tell you that in the future, we think people will be paying, those that like Apple will be paying more, owning more products and services as part of Apple. And so I think the market has caught on to that. That's why it's trading at 30 times earnings. It should trade, Ryan, in our opinion, as the best business in the world. You can argue, you can make fun of me on FinTwit because of it, but I think it should have the same multiple as Costco. I think it should be up there with Costco and Ferrari, two other stocks we own also, as having the most premium multiple. Why should Costco be worth 50 times earnings? Apple's a better business. So I think Apple is undervalued based on the quality of its business. And I do think the growth going forward is going to start to pick up. You know, analysts are looking for 20% earnings growth, and we always love using your, you know, FinChat to research Apple and lots of other companies to come up with, you know, earnings projections. It makes it really easy, you know, and you can use that to see Apple's expected earnings growth in 2025 and 2026. We're looking for remember I said I'm looking for companies with double digit earnings growth? I don't care if the multiple compresses as long as the earnings start to pick up. And so that's why we stuck with Apple through this period where it's been tough. The final thing, I know I've been ranting on Apple for a while, but the final thing is people forgot how well Apple did during the pandemic. And so they're saying, well, there hasn't been growth lately. Well, it's still the hangover from the pandemic. If the proliferation of AI really does take over, everybody's going to need new phones, new AirPods, new iPads, and there'll be another boom again, demand for products and services from Apple. That's my 2 cents.
I like it. Let's talk Netflix. There has been, I guess, a bit of a shift in terms of their business model, or at least that seems the direction it's heading from management with this move into live events.
Uh-huh.
Do you think, it feels like 4 or 5 years ago, as Disney Plus was launching, everyone was talking about the streaming wars and how everyone was going to throw money at this and there wasn't going to be a single winner. It kind of feels like Netflix has emerged as one of the winners. Moving forward, do you think their lead in streaming will continue to expand, or will the competition kind of eat away at some of those subscribers?
Well, it's a good question. They are facing some heavy-duty competitors in Apple and Amazon who can throw a lot of money at live sports and you know, series and movies, who don't mind throwing money out the window, versus some of the other competitors that are in trouble, of course, like a Paramount or a Peacock, you know, where they have legacy businesses that are terrible. And so how much money can you throw at a money-losing business? Disney, of course, looks like it's stabilized, but the winning element, obviously, is Netflix has the global reach, right? It has shows in all different countries and different languages and appeals to everybody. And, you know, a show like The Squid Game, how did a Korean show take off like that? That never would have happened on any other platform, right? But given Netflix global reach, it's just amazing. So Netflix now has the ability to spend a lot of money on live sports. I hope they don't blow their brains out. They're doing, obviously, the biggest test for them is with WWE wrestling. I was the biggest wrestling fan growing up, by the way. So I still tune in once in a while to check out what's going on wrestling. And so far, so good. You can expect probably that relationship with TKO will continue. They'll probably bid for UFC events as well. So Netflix is just going to be the winner. And, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a flywheel. The better content, the more people you get, and everybody wants to then sell their content to the guy who has the most viewers, right? And the advertising starts to kick in. So it's a phenomenal business, but you're paying a hefty price for it. We own it. We love it. But it's not going away in the sales. It's trading at 45 times earnings. And finally, the market is pricing it like it's an inevitable greatest business in the world, which it was or is.
Is there any level of discomfort that you get when you have a business like a Netflix or an Apple and the market starts to give it credit and you see some multiple expansion. Mm-hmm. Obviously, on the one hand, it's, you know, great. That's better returns for your in different accounts. But is there any level of, like, I guess, worry that there would be the multiple compression?
Well, it's a great question. Given our rules of how stocks aren't allowed to get too big in a portfolio, we do trim. We have clients of all walks of life, some living off their portfolios. We need to trim stocks. So we use the ones that have the higher multiples, higher valuations, as a way to fund those sources and to as a way to rebalance portfolios as well, buy more fixed income when stocks are doing well, rebalance portfolios, those kind of things. So it's a good news, bad news. Of course, that leads to capital gains, but you know, you do have to trim when you're running people's money. It's just, you can't let one stock just become a monster. There's the regulators will put you out of business if you make huge mistakes. So I'm not going to sell a stock because of a multiple expansion. It's just not going to do it. I will sell because of the changes in the fundamentals, changes in the management. Yeah, we own Costco. We bought it at many multiples lower than it is today. We're very happy with it. I see it being a lot of predictable growing business. Same with Netflix, same with Apple. And so if we get some multiple destruction, so be it. That's the price you pay. You know, I've owned some stocks now for 10, 20 years. They're going to go down 50% in any one year. It's going to happen. It's happened to me in 2022. It happened to me in during the pandemic. It happened to us during the financial crisis. You know, there's just times and periods where it just sucks owning stocks. And but if the fundamentals aren't going away and they're improving and it's up to the right, we're going to stick with them. That's our process. You can't interrupt compounding because you're never going to get it right. You are not smart enough. When you sell, everybody else is selling, right? Unless you know how to time when to get in and out of stocks, which nobody knows how to do. Maybe one person's the lucky coin flipper. You're always selling at the wrong time. And if you're selling, if you're selling it right, then you probably own a lousy business anyways.
All right. One fun question, and then we'll hit the wrap up here.
Yeah.
If you had to pick one company from the Magnificent Seven that you think would perform the best over the next 5 to 10 years, which would it be?
Probably. I think I probably have the most comfort with Amazon just because of its still infancy in e-commerce. I still see so much growth going forward from e-commerce, and that feeds into other areas that they can get growth. You also get the best of both worlds. You get exposure to cloud computing. You get a little bit of the Netflix-like. You get a little bit of the Costco with their movies and Amazon Prime business. You get a little bit of Costco-like with the Amazon Prime business. You get, you know, so many tangible benefits. And I think they'll eventually offer their robotics and automation to other factories and warehouses. They'll start selling that as a service. So I think on the business model, that's the one I have the most comfort with of all the Magnificent 70.
Okay, last question here. If you could give one piece of advice to someone entering the investment industry today, what would it be?
It's tough right now, obviously, to get a job as like an analyst. You know, more and more of my peers are going to offering exchange traded funds or looking to offer more alternatives to their clients. I think that's going to end poorly for a lot of people, but that's a whole other podcast, Ryan. So what I would say to people who want to get into this industry, it's about relationships. If you want to be successful in wealth management, I know we all want to get the accolades of being a great stock picker and being the next Warren Buffett or Terry Smith or, you know, those kind of people, but we're not. What you need to focus on is building a sustainable business and keeping your clients invested, having a great process, articulating that process, and most importantly, you have to be the voice of reason during times of market panic. And that means a clearly well-articulated strategy to your clients, reiterating that strategy. My job, the reason why I exist is because the markets do go down. No one needs me when the market goes up. Anybody can buy the S&P 500. I should be out of business when the market goes up. It's when the market goes down, when there's bad things happening, those are the most important. So those skills can only happen by working and getting experience in the market, getting comfortable with owning great businesses, in my opinion. Like when the market stinks, what strategy protects you? Oh, sorry, I own value companies, but those value companies are bad businesses to begin with, right? So nothing saves you, nothing protects you like owning great quality businesses. And so that's what I would articulate to people is, you know, do whatever strategy you want, but at least, you know, make it clear to your clients. You know, our business is very different than a lot of other fund managers. This is not a specific strategy, right? I'm not looking for a parcel of a client's money. I'm looking to invest the entirety of their wealth. And so, you know, you also have to decide how you want to set up your business and what products you want to offer. We don't charge our clients performance fees. We charge a flat fee based on size of portfolio. We think that's fair, you know, whether or not one can argue how to set up their own fee structure, but this is the way we feel is right for our clients and our business. So the one word of advice is you got to live through it. You can read a lot of books. You can do back testing. You can do a lot of projections, but nothing teaches you better than, you know, having a number of years in the investing business and having clients yelling at you when the market goes down.
All right. That is going to do it for today. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on this show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or recommendation. Thank you to Barry for joining the show. And thank you again to all the listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time.